I'm Haley.
I'm Sean.
And welcome to Haley Hates Everything.
I pick a surprise topic.
And I get high and opinionated so we can discuss it together.
So grab a snack and hang out with us for
Haley Hates Everything.
Hello, and welcome to Haley Hates Everything. Hey, it's Sean, your co-host, and here she is. It's Haley.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going good. Gonna have an exciting episode today, I think.
Are you sure? Because you sound like maybe not.
I do. Okay. It's gonna be good. It's gonna be good.
Okay, because the energy that you bring is the energy that we meet you at. I want to talk about what we're doing. We got to get straight into it. Sean came up with this idea that we're calling a movie exchange, and we have a special guest that I'm going to introduce really soon. But in this movie exchange, we each pick a different movie. We all watch those movies, and we're going to talk about them. There's some shit, there's some winners, there's everything in between. And without further ado, you know him as our resident He-Man historian. He is a friend of the podcast. He's been my friend for decades, and he is a very talented musician. His name is Brandon Mullis. Welcome back, Brandon.
What? I'm on this shit today, too? Hey.
How's it going?
So, yeah, I guess I'm off of He-Man duty today.
Yes.
And we're going to be discussing some interesting choices. We have a small film festival of our own that we just partook of.
Indeed.
And boy, do we have some thoughts.
So my first question is, do you regret agreeing to this after the bullshit that you had to watch?
Hell no. And I'll expand on that expound on that in a bit. But no, there were some iffy moments. Mm-hmm. There were some moments that I learned from your podcast last year, the kids today would call sus. And I think I survived them. And I'm here to tell the tale. But all in all, I'd say it was a learning experience. And I hope you guys also had an enriching time. Discovering some things that you might not have known before.
I don't know if that's the word that I would use, but okay.
We'll find out soon.
Yes. So my next question, before we get started, since we are on the topic of movies, this is a little all over the place. What is your favorite movie watching snack?
I can't really narrow that down because, like, I got a favorite movie watching meal. That's pizza, but I wouldn't consider that a snack. I love some good kettle corn, but there's some days all I want is just Tostitos and nacho cheese. Like, that's amazing.
But, oh, okay.
I don't know. It just depends. It's like all things. You ask me what my favorite movie would be, that's going to change day to day. So my favorite movie watching snack is going to, many factors have to be considered.
All right. Well, that was a great non-answer. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sean, how about you?
At the movie theaters, it's either like Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, of course. Junior Mints. Those are high up there. Like Red Vines.
Oh, interesting.
I guess nowadays, I really enjoy that cheese and caramel popcorn mix.
Since he took us to the like movie candy like you would buy at the theater, mm-hmm. I got to give a shout out to Dots. Dots are like my absolute favorite movie. They're gummy, but they're not like gummy bears. It's like they're different fruit flavors, but they're just like these little...
They get stuck in your teeth.
Balls?
Yeah, they're kind of like gumdrop shaped. They're like little gumdrop looking things.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. And they're shaped like a bell. Like
kinda,
this with a flat bottom.
Yeah.
Oh,
that
gotcha.
Is them.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. I didn't like those because they were so chewy.
We'll hump you then because them shits are amazing. And you'll know what you're talking about.
She's like, hump me.
Yeah, that's the G-rated or the PG-rated version.
When have
we been
PG-rated?
In case you wanted to have like a radio edit, I'm thinking ahead. I'm giving you options here.
So nice of you. Won't hump me.
What if the FCC steps in on Haley Hates Everything? Then what are you going to do?
Hey, you never know. You never know these days. So not that y'all ask, but my favorite movie snack.
I figured we were getting there. Come on. Don't act like we're some dicks. You're steering this part of the thing.
My favorite movie snack, I'd have to say, is Raisinets, like dark chocolate Raisinets. And I love Bugles. I still try to put them on my fingers, my fingers are too big. So I'll use my little
finger. I forgot about those.
Yeah, I love Bugles, but I like the original ones.
Yeah.
And then if I'm feeling real, like a real salty bitch, I'll go with some Fritos. I love the crunch and I love the smell because they smell like little chihuahua feet and that's wonderful. So
that's kind of suspect there at the end. I don't know how I feel about I love these treats. I love to eat them because they smell like my dog's feet. That's not where I was expecting that to go.
You don't like corn chip feet?
Not when you combine the concept. No.
I'm not saying eating the dog's feet or licking them or anything like that.
Right.
It is bacteria that's making the smell. We should all know that.
I would not be interested in that.
But Fritos smell nice, but they kind of smell like a chihuahua paw. And
yeah, like say Fritos introduced a line of product that was shaped like a dog's foot. That's where I draw the line. It's like, nope, can't do it.
I would do that, actually. I would love that. That'd be my new
thank you for the concept, Frito, but we're just going to go ahead and let this one disappear like Crystal Pepsi.
Do you remember when they had the Cheetos puffs that were like a claw?
Yes.
Oh, I do remember those.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And
that's because they had Chester Cheetah, who was the coolest ass 90s mascot ever.
So we have decided that Sean's going to go first because his movie is something.
Okay. Let's just say, in the words of Metallica, we're about to take Sean's hand because we're off to never, never.
For my movie exchange movie, I decided to go with the 1995 The City of Lost Children. It's a French movie. It's all in French with subtitles. It's a movie I saw when it came out with my dad at an independent cinema in downtown Portland. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before. It had definite, the visuals and all kinds of things were really amazing. I would say... I think Haley's trying not to laugh right now.
I'm trying to give you your time, but...
I think we can both say it was unlike anything we had seen before as well.
After we watched it and I said no, I literally wrote fuck no this big in my notes. And he goes, but have you ever seen anything like that before? And I said, no, nor do I want to.
Take us on the journey, if you will, Sean, to... The folks who haven't watched this film and might be listening to this podcast going, should I go on over to Amazon Prime and dial this bad boy up? Let them know what they're in for if they're thinking that might be what they do this evening.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think of this movie as a mid-90s French noir rom-com adventure. If you had the murder mystery movie starring Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler, but done by maybe Guillermo del Toro or Rob Zombie.
I definitely thought of Guillermo del Toro in this whole exchange. I never thought of any of those other words that you just said.
Rom-com?
Who the fuck is romming here?
Yeah, where did you get that?
Hellboy and the Little Girl? Because that's not
yep.
Good. Okay, yeah.
What?
Have you seen The Professional?
Was he grooming this girl? Because that's a whole interpretation of this film I did not take while I was watching it.
Me neither.
And Sean's over here like, uh-huh.
So basically, the scientist created a number of people. He created this mad scientist, intelligent guy who is unable to dream, so he ages at an accelerated rate. And he made a woman who was a dwarf woman. And then he made 6 exact clones of himself. So in this movie, the kind of mad scientist one who can't dream is kidnapping children just to essentially steal their dreams so that he can stop his self from aging and actually sleep. He has to keep trying to find these different children to find one that isn't afraid. Or he also tries to kind of condition the children he has to not be afraid of this specific nightmare. So in kidnapping of these children, he has these people called the Cyclops that he's working with, kidnapped Ron Perlman as one, kidnaps his little brother, who is actually an infant that he found in a trash can and has raised since birth.
They were like carnival sideshow type characters in
yes.
the film.
Yes.
So they're not like it's not like a traditional nuclear family. They're carnies and they form this bond.
I'm learning a lot about the movie just by listening to what you're saying about it, because there were things I did not know.
So Ron Perlman, he's a strong man for the circus. They steal Denray, his little brother. He has to try and find the kidnappers, and he ends up running into a group of orphans who have been ordered to like rob and steal for the orphanage ladies who are conjoined twins. So he meets up with these orphans. The conjoined twin ladies hire Ron Perlman to essentially steal this safe so that they can break into it and get all the goodies out of it so the orphans can to pay the conjoined twin ladies who own the orphanage.
There was a scene where they used a mouse to get a key for them that I thought was the cutest shit on the planet. I was like, I want a whole movie where they just use a mouse to steal shit for them. This could be the movie, and I would love it.
That would be better than what we actually saw.
They go through with the robbery. They get the safe, and they get it open. They're starting to get stuff out of it. But then Ron Perlman sees the truck that was the kidnappers and drops the safe into the river without getting everything. And him and the other protagonist, kind of main protagonist in the show, Miette, a little girl who's kind of the orphan gang leader. So they end up trying to...
They basically make them walk the plank because they fucked up the robbery. The walk in the plank scene where they're punishing... I'm going to refer to Ron Perlman as Hellboy for the purpose of this review just because it's better for me. The scene where they basically make Hellboy and the little girl walk the plank and this sets up their adventure together for the rest of the film. I put, this little girl in a red dress falls into the ocean and gets saved by what I think is the original for all the clones. That was the scientist who takes her off. And she represents the viewer. Because she hears this dude's story and is like, yeah, I gotta go. This is nut bar. Bye now. She would have drowned her balls off, by the way. Makes her way to Hellboy, but the conjoined ladies possess him and he pimp slaps the child repeatedly, which is something I usually want to do in restaurants. That's a real thing that happened in a movie that I watched. Mm-hmm. I also wrote, this movie must be what tripping balls is like. Oh, boy.
Hellboy and Miette end up saving all the children, and the oil rig blows up, killing the original scientist, but the brain in the jar and the six clones also escape. And so Ron Perlman and Miette and all the orphans are now a family, so... That's how it ends.
Yeah.
That's new to me. That's not what I took from this at all. Just FYI.
So, now, I will say, Haley, I had the same experience where it did take me a second to kind of get a real sense of what was going on. Like, I was kind of doing the thing where you have the plot pulled up on Wikipedia, and like if you miss something, you'll kind of skim to catch up to where you are and go like, okay, now I got it. Like, if I was just watching the film... And I didn't know you motherfuckers were going to make me read, but there were subtitles and I had to adjust to that. Yeah. You know, you're reading the subtitle, but you'll miss a subtle visual that kind of explains something or whatever. It did take me a minute to kind of get what was going on. Like seeing the oil rig and stuff, I was like, what the fuck? There's so many elements here. At first, you know, I thought, okay, these visuals are really cool. I was kind of in for it. I was like, I'm here for this because I've seen films like... Pan's Labyrinth or some of those types of films. I got one here that's called Mirror Mask. That is one that was written by Neil Gaiman, and the visuals are by Dave McKean, who did a lot of his. So there are films like this that are very good, and I saw this and went, okay, it kind of feels like Mirror Mask. I'm excited about this. And then I got lost pretty quick. So I kind of know what you're saying, like I how you feel with that, like trying to piece together the information that you're getting.
Yeah. It's a lot.
And going like, some of this doesn't quite match up, but anyway.
It was really confusing to me and with the reading because I didn't know I was going to have to do that at all.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know it sucked until you said this close. So
wait, until I said that?
Yeah, until you, Brandon, said.
No, I asked you if he had set this up as a joke on us.
Yeah.
I was like, did he do this?
I mean, I was paraphrasing what you said, but yeah. When you said that, then I go, uh-oh, I haven't asked him anything about this.
I don't necessarily think it sucks. I think there's some execution that could have been better.
Okay.
However, like, I would love to see what Tim Burton could have done with this script. You know what I mean? Like, there's a nugget there that I feel like can be executed better. But I don't really know much about the director or anything. Like, I didn't look at all the credits and stuff to kind of see who is this, what else have they done. But... I did like some of the surrealism and stuff, but God, there were just so many things where I felt like, does this character have to be a conjoined twin? No, but let's make her one. Does this thing have to be a brain in a fish tank? No, but let's make it one. It's like, when he was explaining the synopsis just now, it's like, I saw the look on your face and I was like, yeah, I get it. Whoever was writing this went, now we need a complicated thing here.
I didn't know that the scientist was the brain. And I didn't know that the little lady and all of the other people were like made. I knew the clone guy that was like the same guy. I knew those were clones, obviously. But I didn't know all the other people were made from something. I didn't know why there was like a sad room of babies in cribs. But it didn't make sense to me. None of it made sense.
Oh, God, yeah.
And literally 3 minutes into the movie, I wrote, simply no.
Once I started picking up on the plot, I wrote, people seem to be after children. So at first, maybe I thought I was watching the Jared Fogle story or something.
Oh, shit. Oh, my God.
Like, we weren't really aware yet of why everybody wanted kids and were taking them places. And I was like, this might be too much for me.
Yeah, it was really disturbing. It opens on the scary, murderous looking snowman in this fake ass window, like it's a toy store or something.
Oh, yeah.
And I immediately wondered if this was like a birthday movie for Sean because he was born on Christmas Day. Like, he really loved it or something. But I didn't know where it was going, because then it got real fucked up with multiple Santas coming out of a fucking chimney and this wavy, like distorted sort of visual. And I was truly creeped out.
Yeah. Because it like drops us in one of their nightmares, I think, to start.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And you're just like, wait, what the fuck?
The only notes I took during the movie were Haley quotes.
Are you serious? Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
The second thing she said in watching this movie was, this shit is why you're so weird, right?
There was that thing with the snowman and all the nightmare, but then later the guy who's aging rapidly on the oil rig dresses up as Santa and does this weird like David Lynch type Christmas thing.
Yes, that was so freaky.
And I was like, why do we keep doing Christmas related weird shit?
Right.
Like, leave my Christmas alone.
He sang that weird French song and all the children in the cribs were screaming.
Yeah, they all
crying.
Started crying and I was like, oh, this is a sound I love. Let's do this more.
Yeah, and all the scenes lasted way longer than they really needed to. It was just stretched out, the screaming children.
But see, I keep mentioning these names like Tim Burton, David Lynch, he said Guillermo del Toro. There are very talented people who could, I think, do real justice to whatever the screenplay probably was, or whatever the story idea was for a thing like this. I wish I had done more research on the director and stuff. I just know he wasn't the guy. He wasn't it.
I can't tell you about the director and stuff. It was Jean-Pierre Junot. The only other movie you might know him, well, there's a couple, I guess. So American movies, there's Alien Resurrection.
Yeah. Oh, that explains it, because he fucked that series up.
I enjoyed that one.
By the time we got to Alien 4 and he came on board, I was like, nope. Y'all need to reboot this sumbitch because we done killed it.
And then the movie's probably most famous for is Amelie.
Oh, yeah. Oh. That was like his crowning achievement.
Yeah, I think so.
He still has quite a following for that movie. I feel like describing this movie sounds like you're just continually having strokes while you're talking, because just words keep getting put together that you wouldn't normally. There was a sequence where they would, the way that the conjoined twin lady would possess somebody and have them do her evil bidding was like these fleas, I guess, that would jump on them and inject them with a mini hypodermic needle. I was like, that's a cool concept. The budget in this film wasn't really high enough to do some of these visuals justice, but the concept was cool. And every time I saw that sequence, I was like, it almost gets there. Like, it's right up to the threshold of being really well executed. So there were some good ideas here. But man, when this director did the Alien movie, Ron Perlman was in that too.
Dominic Pignon, I think was his name.
Master Raymond?
Yeah, Master Raymond, the one who was the clone. That guy's in every one of his movies. Because he was also in Alien Resurrection.
I know him as Master Raymond from Outlander. He was a French healer / time traveler, spoiler alert. I was very excited to see Master Raymond, but things got more fucked up.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Then some things happened. I remember a scene towards the end where the girl has to go into somebody's dream to get them out or something. Yep. It's kind of like a Nightmare on Elm Street. And I was I still don't know who represented what. Like, I've heard you describe the brain in the jar as the scientist. I thought the scientist was the guy who rescued the girl in the red dress when she fell into the water. Like, he was the one that all this originated with. So there's a lot going on that I don't quite connect it all.
Yeah, wait. Yeah, you're right. The scientist was the diver. The diver and the scientist were the one.
Master Raymond was the brain?
The brain was Uncle Irvin.
Who the fuck is the Uncle scientist? Irving? Here's what I thought. That the brain in the case, who could talk, by the way, you guys. I thought he was the first version of the scary, tall, lurchy
crank
scientist guy who would scream and wear the hats and be in the dreams. Mm-hmm. I thought that was his original thing. And he was having these clones try to make a place where he can be better and have a body, like he could switch bodies or something. And that the other clones were like his Igors that were just helping him out. Is that even close?
No. The diver was the original scientist who created Irvin, but he was plagued with migraines, so he ended up taking his brain out and putting it in the case so he didn't have migraines. Oh. And then he created Crank, but he couldn't sleep or dream, so he aged prematurely. And he created, I think it was Martha the Dwarf Lady, to be his wife. And then he made all
like
the clones.
You do.
The clones of himself were supposed to be the children. So he was like creating a family for himself. But then when the green gas thing happened later on, then he remembered when Crank and Martha attacked him and pushed him off the oil rig. But he had amnesia when he was the diver.
So then his bitch ass comes back with some dynamite and he's like, I'm blowing this shit up.
Yeah.
Oh.
But then as everybody's escaping, he has this change of heart, like, maybe I shouldn't blow everything up. And then a bird, I'm not even fucking joking here, a bird comes in and goes, hell no, I'm blowing this bitch up. And the bird jumps on the dynamite plunger, hits it, and explodes the whole shit. Now, everybody else has gotten away, but the diver, the original scientist, he's strapped to this thing like Greenpeace style, like it's a tree, and he's not going to let them cut it down. And the bird blows his ass to hell. This point, I wrote, I'm not sure if I watched a movie or like entered a trance stage where my mind deteriorated for years, and maybe I'm still in there. Maybe I'm no longer of this world.
I did want to go back to, you were talking about when the little girl goes into the dream or whatever the fuck she does.
Like Freddy Krueger style.
Yeah, because I really did want to read what I wrote because it makes me laugh. So she goes into the little boy's dream. We're back to where we started and the creepy toys stop and the girl comes through the Santa hole to the little boy. Now, I was high when I wrote this, so that's why it says Santa hole instead of chimney. So here's the thing. She switches places with the boy to stay with the nasty man in the dream and then kink and eyes him after he Benjamin Buttons. So he's a baby and she's an old lady and then he's Inception.
Yeah, that's close to it.
Oh, I got something right. Okay.
Yeah, she went into the dream Inception-like to get Denray out and exchange herself with the mad scientist. And then she managed to like do the age reversal thing where she got real old and made him young. And then put him into a loop of him being a child and getting put into the dream machine.
Yeah, that's right.
So then he got into an infinite loop.
Yeah.
And then he just went crazy.
That's why she was able to come out and be okay?
Yeah, yeah. When the mad scientist died, this is what Haley said. Good God, so fucking gross. Everything is so gross. Everything is so scummy and gross.
Yeah.
No, so I did say that I said everything about it is so gross in a way I don't know how to describe. It's weird and skeevy and dank and dirty and mildewy. It's like the shower scum of films.
Let's explore that concept for a moment.
Okay.
Because there was a time when they had not made it to the oil rig yet. Nett is her name. And she's the little girl. And Hellboy are on this. I think they're about to make their way to the oil rig. They've got to have a confrontation with the conjoined twin lady first, and then they can. But Hellboy decides to stop and massage the little girl's foot for a while. Takes her shoe off and just gets right in there. He makes himself real acquainted with that girl's little foot.
Maybe that's where Sean thought they were hooking up.
Spend some time with it. And I remember thinking, what are we doing here? And why are we spending so much time on this? And when are we going to get back to the movie?
There's also the scene where Ron Perlman thought Miet was dead, and he's at the bar, and he's all with the one lady And then she comes in and then there's tension there. I think that was that combined with like the foot rub and stuff. I felt was
the tension. Did not take that. Okay.
The little girl walks in and she's like, "What are you doing with this hoe?"
Wow, you read that really crazy. Really? That's how you saw that scene? Holy shit.
I feel like Haley's judging you a little bit here.
I am.
Look, man.
He chose this movie. How could I not judge him?
He's interpreting this other dude's art. Sean didn't make the scene. So how he interprets this dude's art
isn't necessary. I'm just shocked because I did not take that away at all. To me, I thought he was sad that she had died. So he goes to the bar to get drunk because he doesn't have any way of dealing with his feelings. And the lady comes over and he's like, I just want to drink. I don't really want to fuck it out. I want to drink it out. And so he's like, but then he was starting to be like, maybe so. And then the little girl comes in. She's alive. He's like, holy fuck.
He's like, oh wait, there's a little kid here. We can't get freaky now.
Well, yeah, because he's very excited that she's not dead because he cares about her. And in fact,
he was excited. All right.
I just didn't get that. I thought that the scenes with Ron Perlman, Hellboy, and the little girl were the only, besides screaming children, were the only really human aspects of the movie.
I think that's the intent, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That did come across to me because I did write that down, where I felt like watching them wasn't so bad because it felt like a real story versus all of the other banana kegs shit that was happening all around them all the time.
Like two people kind of forced into an extreme situation who form a bond and have to like suddenly just have to understand each other's like perspective and motivation, and they care for one another and they're attempting to get a thing done. And I do believe that's sort of the intent here. But there were a couple of scenes that made you go, I didn't need that.
There are a lot of scenes. A lot.
The tripping balls effect, if
yes. So the other thing that happened, and Sean is just laughing hysterically through this thing like it's a fucking comedy.
The Santa scene.
He's laughing and he's laughing, and I'm looking at him and I'm looking at it like, are we seeing the same thing? I was literally covering my face in horror because I was so disgusted just by the imagery of the things I was seeing. And I was completely disturbed. And he's just cackling, laughing the whole time, like almost peeing his pants laughing. Yeah. And it really disturbed me.
When Crank comes up and he's in the Santa suit singing to the children, just cracks me up so bad.
That's where I was like, it feels like we went into like Eraserhead or Blue Velvet or some kind of a movie like that, where it was like these scenes that are designed to put the audience on the edge of like going over the discomfort cliff. Like, we want to put you in a place where you're squirming. And that's kind of what I felt like some of the stuff was, like the Santa suit and shit, where like you just can't take it anymore. But you know, there are films that do that purposefully. I don't know if this one was doing it purposefully or if it was just a thing that happened sort of naturally. I'm going to say this real quick, and it's probably going to surprise Haley. This is one of those films where I find myself kind of like thinking of certain visuals in it, like even a week after I've watched it. My brain fills, I think, the full budget version of what they were going for in some of these scenes. Like, I know I'm remembering them a little more spectacular in scope, a little better executed than they probably were in the film. But it's enough to make me, I do think I'm probably going to rewatch it at some point. Like, I'm going to go back now that I know what I'm in for and I can just watch the film and kind of understand it. I probably will revisit it at some point. My point is, my reactions here are honest. I had some weird experiences with this movie. It was not comfortable in any stretch. But I think now that I've seen it and now that I've kind of processed it, like, I'm remembering certain visuals probably would have been better executed with more of a budget, more money. And so I do think at some point I'll go back and take it all in again and just see, like, now from that perspective, being able to, like, look at the whole thing, kind of step back and see the whole thing. Will it hit different? I don't know. So yeah, I figured that would probably surprise you. Probably surprise both of you.
I'm
after
shocked.
Some of the shit I've said. Yeah. But yeah, definitely a weird situation. Definitely a weird experience.
I don't understand the kid burping into the camera. That I fucking hate it.
They did that a couple times and then ended the whole movie with it, like after the explosion of the oil rig.
And the entire movie, he's eating every fucking thing he can get his hands on. Now, I know he's a street urchin, but he's eating like candle wax and he's eating moldy meat and like limes with the peels and shit. He's eating everything, man. And then just burping into the camera. And no one is ever worried about this kid's digestive system or like anything. It's so
weird.
That
kid's digestive system is the least of people's concerns in this weird world where this steampunk shit happens. Like, that kid eating moldy whatever the fuck probably doesn't even hit people's radar when they're like, there's a conjoined twin lady running around with a gang of orphan thieves terrorizing people. Oh no, that kid's eating candle wax. I don't think they even noticed.
She goes, so nasty, so nasty, when he's eating the candle. There's an interview with Jean-Pierre Junot. The first day they were doing shooting with the little boy, he said one day, the kid, all he did was go, I am Zorro, I won't do that. The whole day was shot because that's all he would say.
Oh my gosh.
And so the director threw up?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. He's like, what have I done?
Yeah.
I've taken people's money and I'm making this, and this is what I've got.
At the very end, Haley goes, this little shit is going to burp. And then he burps and she goes, ah, fucking hell.
This was like way too French for me. I hated
and
it.
I was watching halfway through this movie and I remember thinking at one point, what if both of you are watching this 3,000 miles away, like fucking engaged, like just, I'm talking like interpreting the art and feeling it. And like, I'm sitting here going, what is happening? And then we have the conversation and both of you are like, oh my God, you didn't get it. Like, it's a metaphor for this and that and humanity. And it speaks to the this and all of us. And I'm like, what if I just don't get it? What if I'm unique in not understanding what the fuck this is? And I was kind of relieved when I was like, did Sean do this as a joke on us? And she's like, I don't know. I haven't watched it yet, but I'll get back to you.
Would you guys be excited to know that there is a video game, The City of Lost Children?
No.
I think Haley needs to Twitch stream her playing the game. You want to talk about viral fame? Jesus, that's going to be one of the most watched streams in the history.
If I monetize that.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Oh my God. You can have Patreons and shit.
You heard it here first. I'll do it.
Now you just got to find a computer that'll run Windows 95.
This looks like a depressing ass game.
I gotta say, those are pretty good graphics for the time, though. That's impressive for 95 or 6.
Yeah, they're not as blocky, 8-bit.
That like, ain't even, like, I ain't even playing. That's not bad, for especially for PlayStation.
And I did want to read the chain reaction of shit that then, like, killed the conjoined, well, not killed the conjoined twins, but almost did.
I was gonna say, didn't she beat the fuck out of herself? Or she?
Yeah, she got infected with the goo and then killed herself, essentially. Yeah. This is what I wrote. So then Ron Perlman chokes the girl out and her tear lands on a spider web that disturbs a bird, that disturbs a dog.
Oh, that scene.
That disturbs a man who throws a bottle that makes a bird fly off. And then that bird shit on a car. So the car hits a fire hydrant and that stops up the gutters somehow and sends a tray of mice onward to a whorehouse. So the electrician that's working on the lights outside of the whorehouse is watching as all the titties fly by because all of them are coming out. And instead of his doing his job because he's watching the titties, he fucks up the electricity and all the electricity goes out. So then the ship doesn't know where to port. So then it drives up and hits everything and then stops right in front of the twins.
Yeah, I completely checked out during that sequence because I knew what was happening and I was like, nope, I'm just going to wait until the inevitable shipwreck because that's clearly where we're headed. For those who are listening and haven't seen the film, think of the description that Ian Malcolm gives in Jurassic Park of a butterfly flaps its wings on this side of the world and it makes like a storm or a tsunami on this side of the world. It's like the butterfly effect. So basically, yeah, this kid cries a tear. And a ship wrecks. Holy fuck. And it takes us 9 hours to get there.
The City of Lost Children has an 80% on the tomato meter and a 90% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes as well.
I think the tomato meter was drunk that day.
Yeah. Who? What? Huh? Who's watching this? Who's doing that?
On Amazon, On Amazon, 77% of the reviews are 5-star out of 1,400 reviews.
People are crazy. I don't believe this, Sean. I don't believe you for a second. Look at you smirking like that.
Watch it for the vibes, not the actual story. The film is so weird, it will have you talking with your friends for days. The story is so-so, but the cinematography is so good. You won't mind how boring it actually is. 5 stars.
I do agree that it's weird and that you might talk about it for days because it is so weird.
The Turkish Film Critics Association nominated it for Best Foreign Film in 1997. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror nominated it for Best Horror Film, not rom-com. It won a César Award in France for Best Production Design. It won Best Sound Editing for a Foreign Feature by the Motion Picture Sound Editors in the U.S.
Nice.
This is all according to IMDb. Haley, will you be revisiting this film in the future now that you can give it a...
Fuck no. Like, let me show you my notes so you can understand exactly what's going on here.
That says fuck no pretty big. It's about a 70-point font or some shit, I think.
Yeah, I blew that shit up because I was... I was pissed that I had to sit through that thing and
she
that
didn't
I wasn't
just make
warned
it
about
big.
It.
She typed it angrily, I bet.
I did. It was hard and like loud. Yeah.
I bet she broke the F key.
It flew off somewhere.
There was one point during the movie where she goes, angrily, she goes, "You made one of my friends watch this."
"I will never speak again."
I said, that is, I feel so shameful because you made one of my friends watch this.
So do we want to talk about the masterpiece that I introduced the two of you to?
Yes.
The film that I chose was Radioland Murders, 1994, directed by Mel Smith. To describe the Radioland Murders, briefly, it is 1939. There's a fictional Chicago radio station, WBN, debuting on the air with a live audience. Not long after the show starts, a mysterious voice breaks into the program reciting a cryptic rhyming couplet. This continues to happen throughout the night, and every time it does, someone at the station mysteriously dies. The station has to go on with the show. It's their premiere night. They've got sponsors there. They have the entire, like the station manager, the owner, they're all in the house. So they got to keep the show going while danger is on the loose. Meanwhile, the writers are dissatisfied. They're on the verge of strike. They haven't been paid in weeks. And this creates chaos as scripts are delivered at the last minute, sometimes not at all, while the show is live on the air in front of a studio audience and tragedy is striking. It's a comedy slash murder mystery with elements of noir, and while the mystery plays out, you're seeing the program being presented to the radio audience, so you're getting a murder mystery and a variety show at the same time. It's very unique. In my opinion, it's cleverly scripted and criminally unknown. That's my introduction to Radioland Murders. The story was by George Lucas. The script was not written by him. I think there were two or three other writers who took his story, turned it into this screenplay. And then directed by Mel Smith, featuring a quite an impressive, for the time especially, ensemble cast. I don't know if you remember the show Dream On. Brian Benben was the star of that show. He's the main writer here. Mary Stuart Masterson is his estranged wife. She's trying to divorce him, but they're still working together, which creates this tension. You've got everybody from Michael McKean from Spinal Tap. You've got Jeffrey Tambor from Arrested Development. You've got Stephen Tobolowsky from, a lot of people know him from Groundhog Day. He's Ned Ryerson that keeps trying to sell Bill Murray insurance.
I kept trying to think of his name. Yeah.
Christopher Lloyd's in it. Ned Beatty's in it. You've got George Burns, for God's sake. There's like so many people are that like there's a cameo by Rosemary Clooney mm-hmm. when she was still able to get in front of a camera and perform. And Joey Lawrence, for God's sake. I forgot all about it. And
I was so
rewatching
excited
it.
About it. I was like,
and I messaged Haley and I was like, holy shit, I forgot. I suggested a movie to you that has your boy in it, Joey Lawrence. It's nothing his love can't fix.
And Bobcat Goldthwait, you did mention him.
Yes. He's one of the writers.
A lot of people in it.
He's got my favorite line in the movie. They're trying to, there's a segment is live and they're trying to figure out how to close it out. They're frantically writing a script. They're trying to get it to the actors who are on stage about to run out of pages. And he says something along the lines of, what if she takes a carving knife and carves them up and this and that? And they're like, you can't do that. It's a family show. And so Bobcat Goldthwait goes, well, what if he does it to the whole family? he picks up on whatever is said and turns it into something else. Like somebody says something about the kiss of death and he's a writer, he's pissed off, he hasn't been paid, and he's like, I got something else they can kiss. Goes off on a tangent.
I was wondering if maybe George Lucas used to be a page boy at a radio station or something, because there was
that would explain a lot.
A lot about the page boy and a lot of scenes with the page boy's parents.
See, I thought this had like a stage play vibe. Once I looked at it that way, because it was really fast paced, like from jump. And it was very Gilmore Girls to me in that way, because they're fast. They're like throwing stuff left and right. You got to keep up with it. It's going.
Yeah.
And it was a lot to take on, because that was the second movie we had watched that day. And I was like, okay, this is where it's at. And the longer that it went on, I was like, I started looking at it like it was a stage play, because it was really fun to me to imagine how the set would be designed and how it would be presented if it was on a stage. And that made it more fun to me, because I felt like the humor and the acting was so kind of slapstick and over the top that it would probably work really well on a stage. And so once I started looking at it like that, I thought it was really fun and I enjoyed it. Yeah. And it helped me keep with the pace better.
Yeah. The slapstick usually came into play. One thing that I noticed rewatching it was how often somebody would frantically be running the script pages to the actors who need them like yesterday.
Yeah.
And then something would happen, like somebody would open the door in their face and the pages would fly all over. So they frantically get the pages together and they hand them to the actors. And the actors are on stage doing like this domestic sort of drama. And the sweet little old lady gets like her script pages mixed up with this jungle adventure. And she's like, die, infidel.
Yeah.
Die like a dog writhing in pain. And she realizes she's reading the wrong thing and they have to improv something to explain why she just told her sweet like daughter to die writhing from the curse of Nebuchadnezzar.
I thought her facial expressions while she was reading it was really funny too, because not only is what she's actually reading funny in the context of what's happening, but her look where she's like, she can't believe that's what she's having to read.
Because you have to think too, this is all not only playing out for us, the viewer, but it's happening in front of a live studio audience who in 1939 wouldn't have gone to see a sitcom tape. They would have gone to see Abbott and Costello or Zorro or something on the radio. So this lady is not just reading this into a microphone for people in Radio Land back at home to hear over the speaker. She's in front of 200-300 people there in the studio audience too. So she has to kind of keep some composure, but also her poker face kind of fails her a little bit. So.
Yeah. So how long is this supposed to be taking place? So like how many hours does this take place?
I would guess if you think of prime time viewing and television as we know it being like 7 o'clock or so. So, you know, prime time would start at about 7. I would say it probably goes until it's maybe about a 5-hour ordeal tops. So would go until about midnight maybe. It could be shorter.
As the night wore on, I was like, how long are those people sitting in the audience? And have they gone pee-pee? And do they need to eat dinner?
Yeah. There's the scene where the investors get locked in the room and they can't go pee-pee.
That's right. That's right. I forgot about that. I really loved the lights and the colors of the set. The aesthetic of it. Mm-hmm. I really did love that about it as well. That stood out to me. Like the big pops of color.
That was very well done. There were a lot of things in this film that were kind of timeless. When you think about it being made roughly at the same time as, say, a movie like Jurassic Park or Independence Day, it kind of came out around that time. It presented itself very classically. It was, you almost saw, like, obviously in the visual design of the station and things like that, it reflected a more classic era from decades before. But even I think the way that some of the shots were framed and some of the ways that they lit the scenes and stuff like that kind of recalled a classic era of television or something that wasn't really being done in film anymore, just to kind of further transport you back in time. So that, I think, speaks a little bit to what you're saying. They kind of did something different visually that separated this film from other things that you would have walked into the theater around that time and seen.
I definitely thought this movie was made by someone like
it was
in the industry that was kind of jaded, but also wanted everybody to know about all the things that go into making something. So there's a lot of lot with the Foley arts, like you said, a lot of writers stuff, a lot of like even the writer is so good at writing, he's going to write himself out of being the murderer. And like the actors are bad at improvisation, so you got to make sure and get the stuff written by the writers to them.
That's very much like the when how they would freeze when they ran out of script lines. You think of a movie like Anchorman, where Will Ferrell would read anything they put in front of him. So they write, "Go fuck yourself, San Diego," and he just reads it. It's kind of that old trope of this person not being able to just think, you know, in a context of like, I'm on this show, I need to get from point A to point B. Like, no, I'm frozen. I need something to get me there. Hand me a paper with my magic key on it that will take me there. I looked up the cinematographer, David Tattershall, also did The Green Mile. He also did Star Wars Episode 1 and 3, which would explain his connection to George Lucas.
Oh.
Though I will say, this would be before George Lucas was fucking up writing shit like Jar Jar Binks. So he gave the world this story long before he decided, let me go back and pee-pee all over the memory of Star Wars that people have.
It also cracked me up like that the villain was like, he created television 25 years ago, but he was getting stopped by the corporate head honchos because they didn't want radio to go away.
They wanted his idea. And so to explain this part of it, what we learn when we learn who the killer is, we learn that he is jaded and he's taking it out on all of these people who once worked at a radio station in Peoria with him, because these people blocked him from basically having the credit for his invention, which was television. I looked up any connection to Peoria and the invention of television. I either wasn't looking in the right place or I can't find a good connection between. I do know that Philo Farnsworth is the man sort of credited with creating television and coming up with the concepts and the science that works behind it and the tube system and creating pictures that way. But I, again, didn't see any connection with Peoria in that. So I think they just wrote something out of their ass that had nothing to do with Philo Farnsworth or the real history of TV. So we completely are just to suspend disbelief and go, okay, it came out of Peoria. This dude's really pissed off because these guys stole it, whatever. But cool twist. I liked it. I just wish it had tied more into the actual documented history. Maybe if they had some kind of connection to the Farnsworths, maybe he's like a distant cousin of Philo Farnsworth. I don't know.
I think my favorite part was when Roger, the murders are happening, and Roger goes upstairs to the floor that wasn't really used, and he's standing under the dead body, feet are on him, on his shoulder. I enjoyed that was funny to me.
His estranged wife comes up and she's like, "Roger, behind you." And he turns and the guy's feet turn with him, so he doesn't see anything.
And
he
then the toque falls off onto his head.
This would be not Tobolowsky, this would be Jeffrey Tambor's character who wears a toupee, and it falls on Roger's head, and that's when you realize, okay, the Tambor was next to go.
There was like funny things that they would say too that again were like really fast. I feel like this is a movie you could watch multiple times and constantly pick up new stuff. But like when the star lady Claudette, when her husband gets ground up and smooshed in the gears, and they call him mashed potatoes. And I was just aghast, like, oh, they called him mashed potatoes. He just died.
So the stage, it rotates. Like if you think of, for the people listening, if you think of like a Broadway show where the stage is a turntable and it moves. Well, the way to execute that in 1939 is not as easy as just the way that you can do it today. It's these massive cogs and wheels underneath the stage. And so they go down to figure out why the stage is malfunctioning. And of course, one of the deaths is like somebody has rigged it so that somebody goes into the cogs and gets sucked in and squished. After the tragedy happens, they open the trap door and Claudette looks down. She sees it's her husband who basically she's been messing around with everybody in the station. We have learned by this point. And she goes, "Oh my God, he's everywhere." I was just like, Jesus Christ, would that be her reaction?
And I was just like, oh my God, that's so cruel. It was things like that that were in there. And I was I kept thinking about it. And I was like, I bet I could watch this again and catch completely different stuff.
I've been watching it since I was a teenager. I saw it over at a friend's house when it had first come out on video and they knew about it. And so I saw it like kind of secondhand through these folks, and something about it stuck out to me. I was like, I love the humor. It's so different. I knew a little bit about like classic radio programs. I'd heard War of the Worlds and things like that, but I still didn't know much about like Abbott and Costello. And so the humor style I thought was really cool. And there was something about it that appealed to me. And so I remember buying the DVD a couple years later and going like, okay, I want to see this again. And every few years I'll think about this movie and I'll go, I'm going to watch that again. And still to this day, it's like 25 years now, I'm still finding things that stick out that I've never heard before, or just don't. I must have seen the movie 6 or 7 times by now. And something always catches me that just always flew under the radar before. So yeah, absolutely.
Was it those PG boobs?
No, I let me say this. Mary Stuart Masterson in this movie is possibly the hottest human being on the face of the planet. I as a like 15-year-old saw her in this movie. She had to be in her 30s at this point. And I was like, okay, I fully have a crush on somebody my parents' age. I'm just going to admit that. Like,
she did look super pretty. Like, I felt like her hair, her makeup, everything was on point except for her fucking outfit. Which,
I mean, well, it was 1939.
Well, no, but like the top was crooked for most of the movie. And I felt like the jumper she had on, it was a skirt with these wide crisscross straps that crisscross really low, so they're kind of hanging off the shoulders sort of. And I feel like the entire time they were probably falling down and she constantly had to fix them, and that's why she's all crooked, because later on in the movie one of the straps actually falls down during a scene and they just leave it down. I told Sean, I was like, I bet that's been happening the entire time that they're filming this.
Haley is on top of the fashion.
It would
in this
drive
film.
Me nuts.
You've got all this frantic stuff happening, these writers trying to complete scripts. You've got these everything from action to comedy segments that are happening, the skits and sketches that are going out over the air in the film. So they're kind of like not a film within a film, but a presentation within the film. And then once, I think after the second person dies, the first one they think is just a heart attack, and so they don't call the police. The second one, they go, okay, something's going on, we need to call the police. The Chicago police show up, and you've got the trench coat, fedora wearing Chicago cop who comes in, and he's fast talking, and he's so like film noir almost. And so you've got this kind of a thing happening in some of the scenes, and it's just, there's so much going on from so many sort of not different genres, but you've got such different feels to some of the different kind of storylines or some of the different subplots that are happening. And there's so much about it that I love. I do think it drags a bit as it gets toward the end, like as we start getting close to who the killer is, and as the writer is kind of presenting that, and he's having to put costumes on and hide from the cops because they're looking for him. They think the writer is the killer, and he's like, no, I'm figuring this out. He's like, I'm a smart guy. Doesn't mean I'm the killer, but just give me some time. I'm going to come up with it. Well, they don't have any patience for that. I remember thinking the last couple times I watched it, I was like, God, if they could have just found a way to truncate this a little bit. Like, if we could have dropped 20 minutes in the run-up to revealing the killer, it would have been a little bit better.
Yeah,
because
I felt like,
pacing-wise,
with how fast-paced it was, the just the energy of it and the way that people were speaking, I thought, if this happens the entire length of the movie, I'm going to be fucking exhausted.
Yeah.
And I was a little worried. But then once the murders started picking up, I feel like it was slow in places, but I feel like the energy was still there. It just wasn't as fast paced, which like gave me a little bit of a break.
It gives your brain a break a little bit. Yeah. So that might actually be a good thing. I just remember thinking towards the end, I was like, God, I've seen this film enough. I know where we're going, but I feel like we're never going to get there.
The scene that was so crazy to me was the fire hose scene where he's wrapped in the fire hose that's on, but it's like making him levitate.
Yeah.
And like I feel like that's got stretched out quite a bit.
Yeah. And today, if we were going to make this movie today, I'm sure they would put Melissa McCarthy in that fucking scene
so that she could
be the one aiming the hose at something. She gets knocked down and she probably farts, and I'm just like,
I'd say Melissa McCarthy or Kevin Hart.
Yeah, one of the two. So were we pleasantly surprised? Did we look at this film and go, what the fuck? Like, what was our experience watching Radioland Murders for the first time?
I was a bit bored.
You were bored with this rapid fire comedy?
At one point, he looked at me and he says, was Brandon fucking with us? I think Brandon
like
was
suggesting
fucking with me.
This as a joke. What gave it away? Was it the cyborg station manager or the Siamese twin audio engineer with an army of thieving children, or the brain in the aquarium that wrote scripts?
The end was long for me. You. And I don't know. There's a lot of like the tropes of a lot of door humor. There's the trope of falling down the sign, but then like tilting.
That sign scene, the writer is escaping the police and he's trying to climb up there's a ladder on the side of the building. He's climbed out of a window. He's trying to go to another floor so that they can't see him. Of course they see him. They start shooting at him. He's on the letters on the side of the building. He's like hanging on to those, the call letters to the station. They start rotating. It does go on a bit long. And for some reason, I had remembered that as being the part of the end sequence because they chase the actual killer up the antenna on top of the building towards the end of the film. And I got there and I was like, oh shit, this is just the writer being shot at kind of like somewhere in the middle, late middle of the film. And it doesn't tie into the end. I was like, wow, I remembered this way wrong. But yeah, I agree. That scene was kind of, I don't know, it was a bit much. We'd already had the fire hose and all that shit at this point, I think.
Well, that didn't crack later,
but we didn't need them both.
Because right before that was where, the reason he was out there is because he faked his own death. And then they thought
he acted like he was like, jumping to his death.
What a bunch of Nimrods.
That cracked me. Which, interestingly enough, I don't think people were using that as an insult yet in 1939. Looney Tunes turned that into an insult. Mm. Have you ever read that story or heard that story?
No.
Nimrod in the Bible was a very successful hunter. Like he was the greatest hunter the world had ever seen. And Bugs Bunny would taunt Elmer Fudd by calling him Nimrod, basically saying, you're this biblical hunter from the Bible, but mocking Elmer Fudd because he sucked at hunting. And so once he called Elmer Fudd Nimrod enough, people started using Nimrod as an insult. But that came from Bugs Bunny. They would not have said that in 1939 as an insult to somebody. That's just my little useless trivia nugget that I wanted to share. Because that stuck out to me and I was like, wait a minute, not yet. Nobody would have said that then. I love the idea of Sean thinking that this classic murder mystery set against the backdrop of the golden age of radio with quick wit, fast-paced storytelling, who's who of comedy for God's sake, from Spinal Tap to Bobcat Goldthwait, I'll mention him here.
And five scenes with the Page Boys parents.
In his 98th year, George Burns is up there slaying, rounding a freaking stellar ensemble cast. I've already named a bunch of them. And you wonder if I suggested this as a joke for you. How dare you, sir? Who the hell do you think you are?
How did I feel about it? I liked it. I would watch it again because I do feel
I highly
like
recommend
that you would see new stuff. There were bits that were a little corny to me. Mm-hmm. Some of the slapsticky stuff that doesn't always land with me. Overall, I enjoyed it and I thought it was fun, especially when I started looking at it as like a stage thing and how would that be done. And I enjoyed the pace of it. I enjoyed all of the actors, like being able to see them. And oh, Michael McKean's faces, he made the funniest facial expressions constantly, and I couldn't wait till he was on camera again because I wanted to see what face he was gonna make.
Yeah, there's a scene where he's doing something like the band has to fill, something goes wrong and the band has to strike up a song to kind of fill time for the audience, and he's got these like drumsticks or something, he's using his drumsticks and he's playing a melody on like the bottles that are hanging in front of him, and he turns to the camera and he's like chewing gum and he winks at you.
Yeah, he does the wink and stuff.
I'm just like, he's so fucking cool in this. Like, he's amazing. He's never not good, but he's just, he's that thing that you can put into a movie, pretty much any movie, that's just going to make the experience a little better. Like, he's going to give it an extra shine. And I love him. But this movie is conveniently available on Blu-ray with zero special features. I highly recommend adding it to your library, especially if you have The City of Lost Children in said library. It needs a film like this to round out the quality of the library. Don't even act like the King Kong ending of this wasn't amazing.
Oh, I called it a 9/11 ending.
Hey.
I know.
Too soon.
Yeah.
Too soon. I suggest Sean rewatch this. Give it another couple of 3-5 chances.
True.
See what he thinks.
True.
You mentioned the Foley basically the guy making the sound effects for the programs as they go on. We didn't even say, I don't think. That's Christopher Lloyd, for fuck's sake. He's so eccentric and he's making the faces and he's doing all this, but he's trying to find like the perfect sound effect for certain things. Like there's a part where he's hung up on like the human head getting smacked by something and he like hits a watermelon and that doesn't do it for him. And he's like, I just still can't find the sound. I guess he's supposed to be some German guy or something. And they swing a boom mic and it hits this old lady in the head. And he looks up and he's like, that's it. So, a lot of what you see with him is just unspoken comedy of him being very Christopher Lloyd-like, making the sound effects.
I did think the bellboy was the murderer, to be honest with you.
Oh, you did? I don't think that ever occurred to me, like when I was watching it the first time.
I thought he was being too nice, and everybody liked him too much, so it had to be him.
Yeah, I think he came across too much as just sort of the lovable, kind of aloof, like he was
kind of dumb, but...
Yeah, I kind of saw him as too not really worked in enough to...
See, I thought he was like the sort of a background person who he could go around doing stuff everywhere. So it kind of, in my mind, it made sense that he could have a little hand in everything without it being noticeable.
That is a good call, because without spoiling it, I guess we're not going to say who the killer was, but who the killer wound up being, you would wonder how could he get the time or the... opportunity to do some of these things or set some of these things up. And then you wonder, like, maybe somebody was working with him. Maybe there was an accomplice.
Well, that was my next question, because who's the voice that was on the thing? Was that supposed to be his voice? Or
they mentioned that was a recording at one point.
Oh, okay.
So it wouldn't require a live mic.
Okay.
My thing about that is, here's another little nugget of information about time, like the time that we're dealing with. In 1939, there was no recording to tape. You would have had to record to a disc, like basically, I forget what kind of, like basically a metal master that records would be pressed from. It really could only have been played from a record. And that's some pretty intricate shit. Number one, somebody's got to cue up these records. You can't just hit a button and then a message plays. There's no tape. So I get it, just as a quickie explanation that audiences in 1994 aren't going to question.
Yeah.
But knowing what time we're dealing with, the only method of recording something, there was no magnetic tape. In reality, Bing Crosby and Chet Atkins kind of oversaw the use of magnetic tape being used in recording and music, and they kind of proliferated that in the late 40s and early 50s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Now you do.
That's cool.
Bing Crosby was like, not just a million selling artist who got the nation through the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. He was a damn pioneer in recording technology. And all we remember him for is White Fucking Christmas.
It's time for Far and Away.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the movie that I chose. And I'm so happy. I love this movie, and I always have. It would be the movie that I would tell people was one of my favorite movies. It's just one of those that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
Y'all looked at me when like this movie... I was fucking insane.
No, when this movie came out, I was, we were like 12, I think, at the time. And I remember telling my stepsister I wanted to see this, and she's like, really? Far and Away? I was like, yeah, it looks awesome, because there was a little bit of like the history aspect of it. There was like him as a boxer. There was like a lot of stuff in the film that I thought, from the trailer at least, that I thought would be cool in a film. A lot of it went over my head at that age. Mm-hmm. I was just like, a lot of there's too much going on here for me to fully understand it. But as I got older and watched it, I can definitely understand why a person would feel that way about this movie.
It is written by Ron Howard and Bob Dolman and directed by Ron Howard. It is a Brian Grazer, Ron Howard joint. Joseph, who is played by Tom Cruise, and his landlord's daughter, Shannon, who is played by Nicole Kidman, travel from Ireland to America in hopes of claiming free land in Oklahoma. The pair get sidetracked in Boston, where Joseph takes up boxing to support himself. When he loses a pivotal fight, the two are left penniless. Now faced with poverty, the two must find new ways to scrape by. As their affection for each other grows, Joseph questions whether he is truly what Shannon needs in her life. Most of the film is like 2 hours and 20 minutes, but apparently there's a 30-minute extended cut that's on a bonus DVD thing somewhere.
Oh, damn.
And actually was the version that was released to TV because they needed the extra 30 minutes to run it in two two-hour presentation. Yeah. It was filmed from May 1991 to September 1991. They filmed the Oklahoma scenes in Montana, in Billings and Bozeman, and then they filmed in Dublin and some other places in Ireland as well. And they did all of the Oklahoma, Montana shots first and then went over to Ireland and did the rest of the film. I thought that was interesting. The music was composed and conducted by John Williams. And they also brought in...
Oh, that motherfucker ain't shit.
Wow. Jesus. You got fighting words for John Williams?
I know. I'm fucking playing because we're talking Jaws, E.T., Star Wars, Superman. Come on.
This is a tangent. But look, it's my Return of the Jedi book from when I was a kid. I loved this thing, and the binding is all like tearing apart. But look at Luke. It's just
is that the picture that used to make you skeet?
Yes. That was that scene was so good, you guys. So good. So oh yeah.
That was her slave Leia outfit.
Yes. Yes. You get it. You get it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Here we go. Hold on.
Get to the money shot.
Wait a minute.
Oh, they left me hanging.
We literally have a thing that we're in the middle of, and Haley is getting worked up on Mark Hamill.
I
over
said
here.
It was a tangent.
Yeah.
Okay, you're welcome.
That's different. That's just you sitting there having a moment, and we are feeling like maybe we should step out of the room, so to speak.
I'll let you watch.
Step away from the computer. Good God. Mark Hamill has quite the effect on Haley.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Mark Hamill and weed turn Haley into a different human being.
I think it's a little bit the purple hair too, quite honestly. Ron Howard did a TV pilot with Bob Dolman, the other writer, and they both really wanted to do a movie about Ireland, and so they started developing the script, which took 8 years to develop.
Whoa.
Yeah, and during the writing of it, Dolman ended up discovering a cache of letters written by a 19th century woman that was on her way to meet her husband in Oklahoma that he felt breathed new life into the research that was basically just textbooks for him to that point. When they were talking about the casting, Ron really wanted Tom Cruise and Grazer really wanted Kidman, but Ron didn't know that they were dating at the time. They weren't even married yet. And it just ended up that way, apparently.
Is this movie the prequel to Eyes Wide Shut?
Wow.
Like, after they build their home in Oklahoma and shit, then they wind up in, like, the swinger club scene.
Maybe it's, like, the Yellowstone universe, where that's, like, a family that was there decades before, and then you get the family stories from, like, different centuries or whatever the fuck they do. I haven't watched Yellowstone.
Or, like, Cloud Atlas, yeah.
Because there's also the one where he was a NASCAR driver. Days of Thunder.
Days of Thunder, yeah, that's when they met.
Okay, I was wondering on the timeline.
Yeah, Nicole Kidman, yeah, she was in that.
Oh, I forgot she was
in that. Yeah, so that's when they met, and Tom Cruise mentioned to Ron Howard that he enjoyed working with her on Days of Thunder and would they maybe consider her for a role in this film. And that's when Ron Howard said, oh, well, Brian already mentioned her. And he had no idea that they were dating. Why did I choose this? One, obviously, because I fucking love it. Two, the scenery is my shit. We've got rolling hills. We've got moss on rock walls. We've got the fucking ocean right there. We've got donkeys and thatched roofs. And it's Ireland, right? Blah. Wonderful. I had a huge thing for Tom Cruise, as many people did, especially at that point in my life. And
before the Scientology.
Yeah. Just, I enjoyed his beauty. I loved him since Legend.
People listening at home, there was a time before he jumped up on Oprah's couch.
And, there was, and I promise.
Made America go, what kind of drug is that man on?
So, yeah, I was super into him, super excited about that. I loved that he was Irish in it. I love the accents, even though things can be questionable, but just an accent in general. Mm-hmm. Bagpipe music, yes. Romantic, sort of epic, yes. Period piece, yes. Give it to me. So, I love this movie. I was happy to watch it again, but I have a few things that I would say that I have changed my mind about, but overall, still fucking love it.
One thing I kind of noticed in this rewatch of it is that I kept thinking, gosh, he's the Zac Efron of his village. like with the, he had the hair down and stuff.
I actually wrote down, this is my note about him, his Henley, his hat, his hair, his bone structure. I love the Frodo moment when he leaves the village on the donkey.
I wrote for that opening scene where, you know, they come and burn the house and shit.
Yeah.
I said, these fools shook down motherfuckers burying their father for rent money, then burned their house, and the award for most villainous characters ever goes to these bitches. Also... I love that Tom Cruise was like, that's it. I'm going to America where they famously love Irish people and landlords are super nice, especially to foreigners.
Oh, shit.
For the purposes of this review, I will be referring to Tom Cruise as Maverick.
I'll try to keep that straight. All right. So just to let the people know, if you haven't seen Far and Away, it opens in Ireland. It's 1892. Basically, the people who work the land and have homes there, it's not really their land and they have to pay rent, and rent is like crazy high. And there's all these assholes running around burning people's houses down if they don't pay the super high fucking rent, even though some people just don't have enough money.
The landlord behind it all is the dude that Robin Williams worked for in Miss Doubtfire.
Oh, is that him?
Yeah, he was the station manager. That gave Robin Williams the job on the show and shit.
Okay. I really we heard they burned down the house, obviously, of Joseph's family. Now, Joseph has got two brothers who are dickweeds, and Joseph decides, I'm the one that's got to do some shit, so I'm going to go avenge my father's death. And
Joseph is Maverick.
Yes. Sorry, Maverick.
I'm just letting the folks know.
Okay.
And key point you do need to know about his death, his dad's death, is that he dies twice.
Yeah.
You have to know this.
And then he comes back like Jesus, and then he dies again.
Maverick goes to look for his landlord, who shows up at a bar somewhere in Ireland. And Maverick finds out, oh, this is the guy I'm looking for. Oh, fuck. Turns out he's been really nice to me, but like, this is the guy I gotta kill. So now I'm gonna go kill him. Follows him to his house, but shit happens.
He tries to bust a cap in front of his family, and then the gun blows up in Maverick's face. And so this all leads to the daughter of the landlord peeking at Maverick's junk. She goes, hey, there's a ding-dong in this room. Yeah. I'm going to look at it.
She's going for the Oscar on that, like, that's dick peeking.
She was not adhering to the Me Too movement at all.
Well,
she violated Maverick.
As a 12-year-old, it was one of my favorite things. It's just like, ooh, what's under there?
A dick.
What does it look like?
It looks like a dick. And I believe I've told you, I can't take any dicks in this episode, so we're not allowed to. Don't go finding pictures, goddammit.
I at least know things that were entertained to be shown to you, but I tried to put the kibosh on it. I'm just saying. So we'll see what happens, but I make no promises.
Yeah.
I tried.
Uh-huh.
The bowl scene. All right, let's get to it. Tom Cruise, Maverick, he's been injured. Joseph, whatever the fuck you want to call him.
Uh-huh.
He's unconscious. He's laying in a bed, no clothes on. He's got a bowl over his junk because the mom has been called away and she doesn't want Shannon, Nicole Kidman, her innocent eyes to be fucked up by the side of a penis. So Nicole Kidman,
instead of like, just let me pull the covers up, she's like, let me precariously balance this bowl on the dude's area here, and I'm sure nothing will happen when I walk away from this room.
Well, she expected her daughter to be very accustomed to the rules and adhere to those niceties. And Nicole Kidman was like, I want to know what's under there. She lifted up that bowl and she liked what she saw. And that leaves the viewer wondering, what did she see?
A dick.
I know, but they're all different and they all have different properties. Tom Cruise wakes up and wakes up and he tries to kill the guy who he knows burned down his house.
When he spit in that guy's face, that was the juiciest spit.
Man. Oh, that was nasty stuff. The landlord has got this dude to do his bidding, but I forgot his name. And he's played by Thomas Gibson. And he is also really into Shannon. Yeah. Like, wants to
I can't tell
down.
If he's like some kind of a constable or something, or if he's just a dude that is going to hold Tom Cruise there for the police or something. The landlord is the 1%, so he's got people that will, even if it's not entirely legal, they're going to look the other way.
And so this guy totally wants to bang the boss's daughter, and Shannon, she's like, I want to live life to the fullest. None of this bullshit classical music for me. No, I want some band music, bitches. She goes to tell him the piano. Well, that gives Maverick some time to make it down the stairs to shoot people. Again, fuckery doo-dah, and they catch him. And they're like,
yeah, he's
pistols
still
at
successful.
Dawn, bitch.
But before they can do pistols at dawn, Nicole Kidman wants to run away from home. Right? Mm-hmm. So she thinks, I need to take this gangsta who just tried to kill the shit out of my daddy with me. Maverick says, you can take America and stuff it down your pee hole. I ain't coming. But then the duel doesn't go so well. Mm-hmm. It's foggy. Who comes swooping out of the fog besides Nicole Kidman swooping up Maverick to take him off to America? And suddenly he's just like, yeah, this is what I need. I'm gonna go now. I was not into it last night, but I'm totally going now.
Well, between Nicole Kidman and death, I choose Nicole Kidman.
He had made his choice. He was like, I ain't got nothing to do with your bitch ass. I'm going to shoot this dude, and then I'm going to shoot your daddy, and then I'm going to shoot your mommy and your grandma if she's around too.
That was his plan, but...
Yeah, exactly.
They get on a ship to America. They're going to Boston. And Maverick has to pretend to be Nicole Kidman's servant boy.
He's way into that idea.
Yeah, oh yeah, super into it. But then they also meet this guy named Mr. McGuire on the ship who Shannon takes to because he's American. He's fancy boy.
And he's a very important character. Get used to him. He's going to be around for a long time.
Yeah. And this is where they learn about the land that is being given away for free in Oklahoma, where they can go get their own land. It's just they have so much, they're giving it away. And this is just the part of the podcast where I want to remind people that the land was stolen from the indigenous people who were murdered and raped and displaced. But I do have some extra information about that I wanted to share. This is land becomes Oklahoma in 1907. This Cherokee outlet was one of three areas that the Cherokee Nation had acquired after a resettlement, and they had this unassigned territory, and there was a group of people known as the Boomers who were fucking with the politics of everything and convincing the government to open all these public lands and stuff, and President Harrison signed a presidential proclamation that forbade the grazing of cattle on this Cherokee land. And that was how the Cherokee got their money, was from leasing the land to cattle ranchers for the cattle to feast on. So this presidential proclamation kept cows from being on that land, and they weren't able to use the land for anything or get money from it. So this land that they had been given back, finally they were told, well, you can't use it. So they were like, all right, well, fine, then we'll sell it back to the government. And the part of the agreement was that individual Cherokees would also be able to claim parts of the land in this outlet once the land was being given away. So a little bit of history facts.
They did not explain that in the film.
No, there was nothing mentioned about any of that. So,
which was very reflective of the time. I'm sure nobody was having that discussion when they were like, all right, get your horses and your wagons ready. We're going to ride out and plant some flags today.
Yes. We get to Boston, and there's lots of Irish discrimination. Mr. McGuire turns out is a fucking dick because he stole Nicole Kidman's family spoons that she was going to sell for money so that she could live a hoity-toity life in Boston.
You know what happens to Mr. McGuire, though? He gets fucking shot. He gets gunned down in the streets of Boston. And then he's not a character anymore.
I do want to mention about Mr. McGuire. Now, it's a big deal because he stole the spoons. And she's like, Mr. McGuire, my spoons! Mr. McGuire stole my spoons!
But his ass is laying there in the street. She could have just picked him the fuck up.
Well, yeah, she could have done something. Exactly.
Why didn't they pick them the fuck up? It's not like there was a gang of armed people stealing the spoons going, stay back, we're taking these spoons. I was like, you're right there. You're 3 inches from this, but pick them up.
No, I agree with you.
Get some of your goddamn spoons.
I agree with you.
These spoons ain't got legs.
Okay, this is something that I say because I don't know if you've heard of the spoon theory of like chronic illness and stuff.
Is this like in the Matrix where there is no spoon?
No, oh, but okay. The spoons do run out. Anyway, it's basically like if you have a chronic illness or an invisible illness, you're going to have different amounts of spoons you can use in a day, different levels of energy, and you can kind of measure it by spoons. So maybe you feel like you have 20 spoons that day and you use 5 of them to take a shower. And so you've only got this many to do these other things to try to sort of plan out your energy level so you don't try to overexert yourself when you know you have a specific level. So anyway, this is something I say a lot where I'm like, Mr. McGuire, my spoons, when I'm just feeling rather down and not low on energy.
And she does.
Yeah. And then Sean can now say, they're right there. Bend over and pick them up. These spoons ain't got legs.
Oh yeah, that'll
they ain't going nowhere. Just get your goddamn spoons.
That'll be met with laughter and understanding.
She means uppercuts, suplexes, and probably a body slam.
She so wants to be able to, like, punch somebody right in the balls.
They go to basically, like, an Irish ward, and they walk in, and Tom Cruise is like, let me do the talking, because I know these folks. These are my people, like, kind of gruff street-type folks. He walks in, and he just smacks the shit out of a dude. And then the ward boss is like, oh, my God, you beat the crap out of that man. Would you like a place to live? And then, boom, they have a place to live. It's pretty magical.
That gets us to the brothel that they're living in. They have to live. They have to share a room and pose as brother and sister living in a brothel.
Because somebody had committed suicide that day. Nicole Kidman's like, oh, wasn't expecting America to be like this. And Tom Cruise is like, you wanted to go out in search of adventure. Here we are winging it. Meanwhile, though, back in Ireland, the landlord finally gets some karma because a bunch of people burn his bitch ass house and they're like, welcome to being the 99% douchebag. How do you like it?
I thought it was funny that the guy Steven was the character's name.
Oh, that's right.
Ran back into the fire to grab the picture of Nicole Kidman.
A lucky coinky dink. Okay, so yes, back in Boston, Nicole Kidman is now working at a chicken plucking factory. So this is the part where I want to add that Joe McIntyre's sister, Judy, is in this movie. She's the little redhead friend of Nicole Kidman in the chicken plucking factory. And she has a few speaking parts as well.
Oh, my God. I had heard that for so long and I never knew. I had never heard that. But thank you for
I was like, letting really? Me know.
No. This has never crossed my radar. But now I know.
Oh, my God.
God, sometimes you're funny, but
I had said I had said earlier I did plan to start with you. There I went. In that scene, I like that the way the writers kind of establish it, like, oh, this Nicole Kidman, she's going to be a feisty one as she's sort of like getting out into the world and learning who she really is, because she makes some comment to the fucking like asshole foreman and he's like, there goes your day's wage, I'm withholding your wage for talking back, and she's like, why don't you go ahead and take Damar and fuck off? Suck a dick, you asshole. But basically, I don't know. You know.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh, and take Friday too, so I can say this and that and the other thing. And you got Maverick over there in the corner basically being like, stop it. Money would be good. Why don't you not fucking give away all of it? But yeah, that was pretty badass. I like how that was done.
And the manager guy was Clint Howard, Ron Howard's brother.
I knew I recognized him. And he's obviously, like, character acted in a lot of things. He's been, like, he's one of those faces you see and you go, I know I've seen him in, like, 40 things.
We go to the clothes washing scene, and that brings us to, like, they're wearing less clothes. They're getting a little frisky for each other. Man, I tell you what, let's talk. As a 12-year-old, loved this scene as well, because you can just see the top of his butt and the top of his hips and just, like, that curve. And I was just like Nicole, like I wanted to look through the curtain and see what I could see. And so I pretty much enjoyed that scene very much.
I like how she's peeking at him the whole time. And it's like this scandalous, like, ooh, she's seeing things she shouldn't be seeing and whatnot. Meanwhile, she's already looked at his full on dick.
That's true, but she wants to see it again, and he didn't know that she saw it, so she doesn't know.
Oh, I know he didn't know, but she's over there looking through the little screen or the hole in the screen, and I'm like, you already could draw it from memory. You could pick it out of a police lineup. Like, do you just need to fill in the blanks now? You're looking at the rest of them.
And then he's peeking the whole time and gets so frustrated that he has to go start a fight.
He hears the people next door like banging or whatever, yeah. And then he runs it's out of there much. In like a frustrated rage and just smacks the shit out of a guy. Also in the room where he punched a guy out to earn a place to live. Yeah. And then the ward boss is like, oh, how about I give you a job beating ass for money? Plot development.
He's kicking mm-hmm. ass at the club. Shanna is becoming less hoity-toity. She's still plucking chickens. She's really jealous of all the attention and the money that he's getting from his job at the club. So she decides that she wants to dance there, I think, to get his attention. Yeah. And maybe some extra money, but she wasn't really thinking that through. He goes to a fight that goes wrong because she's there. Like, he's pissed off that yeah. she's being manhandled.
All this time, by the way, we learn that through a twist of fate with her father, she's been sending letters to her father, the constable type who was mm-hmm. trying to restrain Maverick when he was trying to murder her dad. He's on his way over to America. He knows where she is now, so he's making his way west so he can find her and, I guess, take her back home. So all this is happening while we know, like, he's making a beeline for whatever adventure they're up to. Basically, a miracle payoff comes Maverick's way. They're like, there's a fight. We know you can win. I'm going to pay you $100. And then another guy's like, I'll match it. We got to see you fight this guy. What could possibly go wrong? Maverick's like, I'll do it. That's all the money we need to get to Oklahoma. We got this.
It does not go well. Maverick gets his ass beat. They get kicked out of the brothel because the ward boss guy's like, fuck you. You fucked all this shit up for me. Fuck you. You get yep. nothing. I give you everything and you fuck me over.
He takes like everything he can take from them to recoup yes. some of the loss.
All
it's like,
the
they
money,
got nothing.
All their mm-hmm. shit, everything. Kicks them out.
They are instantly
snow.
Broke as fuck. No place to live. No nothing. This is where they break into a house.
Ooh, yeah.
After they get kicked out, the couple breaks into a nice house to pretend that they have shit again for a minute. And Nicole Kidman is all, I dreamed a dream in time gone by. And then in like no time at all, she gets shot. And Maverick picks her up and takes her to the old boyfriend who's been tracking him. Maverick just happens to know where he is. So he knocks on the door. He takes her in there. He's like, surprise, motherfucker. He helps Nicole Kidman. He's going to nurse her bullet wound and shit. Maverick's like, okay, y'all got this? Cool. I'm out. And then he just goes west.
He's yeah, just like, he leaves very fast.
He's like, she's safe now, bye.
And while they were in the house, they confess that they have feelings yeah. for each mm-hmm. other. They like, finally have that sort of realization and some kind of intimacy. He's working on railroads now. He's in, I think he's in Missouri or something at that point, maybe.
Yeah.
And is daydreaming about her constantly.
He had quite the imagination. They had the kiss, and then he's like, well, what happens next?
Isn't everybody like that though?
He's like, let me just go ahead and replay this in my mind the way it should have happened.
He feels like he's missing out on his destiny at this point because he has a daydream or in Ireland, and his dad is telling him, you have to, a man's own soul is his land, and you have to get your own land and land, go get the land. And so he's like, you know what, fuck it, there goes the wagon, off the train, and let's go walking.
Then we get to find out that Shannon is with Steven.
Maverick quickly sees Shannon. She's there with the whole fam.
Wouldn't you know it? They just happen to make their way to the same fucking camp. He goes up to her and he's like, we good? And she's like, yeah, we good. And then her man sees that and he goes up to Maverick and he's like, you stay away from my property, which is that lady over there, by the way, because it's 1892, or I kill your ass.
Now, this is the part of the podcast where I am adding some more history because I found out some more little tidbits. I did a deep dive. Mm-hmm. May I share with the class?
Yes.
So, Ron Howard has a personal fondness for Far and Away because he does have Irish roots, and in his family history, two of his great-grandfathers rode in the Oklahoma Land Race. And he wanted to be able to tell a sort of a personal story of something that could happen to get these people to that race. So he had that history with him and his family. For the scenes, they were shot in July of 1991 in Montana. There were 800 riders and extras. There were 900 horses, mule, oxen, and 200 wagons that were on a quarter mile wide set, and 9 cameras were used to film the sequence. During the filming, 4 people broke bones and 1 horse died.
Oops.
When I saw that shot where they had the photographer going up onto the platform to take the picture, and you see everybody is lined up and they're ready to, basically they're ready to fire off the starting gun and have everybody go. I remember thinking like, okay, this was 92. This is not movie trickery. Like they put all of these people, they corralled all of this that you're seeing here in a way that would never be done again. Like this is just not something that would happen today. You think about the Marvel style of filmmaking and you can have an entire Infinity War happening or whatever the hell, the Infinity Stones, the fight and that. And you can do it all on computer. And like just to be there when this was shot and to look across that field and see all of these wagons that were built and these people on horseback in the period costume, like it had to have been like waking up and going to work and stepping back in time. I can't imagine what that felt like to be on set that day.
I read an article where Tom Cruise said his horse was very much like the horse was depicted in the movie, where it's just kind of crazy and wild. Once the cannon went off and he was riding, all he heard was like the thunder of everything around him, and there was just dust and he couldn't see anything. And he said it made him feel like he was back in time in that moment, what it must have been like, just all this chaos happening around you.
Everybody's rushing for land. Yes. They got their flags. Mm-hmm. They're going to get their land. The landlord, of course, has found a way to cheat. That's neither here nor there. He's doing his thing because he's a privileged white man. But Nicole Kidman's mans from back home totally makes good on his promise to kill the shit out of Maverick, and he Yokozuna splashes him with his horse, just bam.
Horse, yeah. Head rock. Yeah.
And guess what happens? Maverick kicks the bucket. But just like his dad did, Maverick pulls a Jesus and he resurrects. Callback, because that's the thing that you can do in his family.
And doesn't he say, I won't die twice? Is that what he says?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
I'm like, well, we'll see.
So when he comes back, which, by the way, he came back because she Sleeping Beautied his ass.
Yes, that's true.
She's basically like, no, you can't go. I love you. Kissy. And then
her
he's back all of a sudden.
And the magic spread out across his body.
Well, the tear dropped, it hit the spider's web, a bunch of stuff happened, the ship wrecked into
the bird
pier.
Shit on the car window.
And then Maverick came back.
Yes.
They put the flag in the ground, and then Nicole Kidman's mans from back in Ireland, mm-hmm. he sees all this happened, and he basically is like, I had it pretty good in Ireland, and now this is my life. Yeah. I'm done with y'all.
Yeah, now he's stuck in Oklahoma for a while.
He's really got to reinvent life at this point. But Maverick and Nicole, they're well on the way to joining their swinger club.
Now, Sean, I heard you say, while Brandon was going on the chain reaction thing, that would have been a better movie. Did you not like this movie?
I think he just wants everything to be, like,
weird.
I'm just saying, instead of just him just suddenly waking up, what if it was a chain event series? It would have been that much more satisfying.
I obviously had seen it. It's been a while. Mm-hmm. I think I was a teenager the last time I watched it. So it was like seeing it again for the first time. It had been a long time. I knew the gist. I knew a lot of the visuals. I could like recall the scenes in my mind. The production design was still kind of with me because it's one of those movies that stays with you. You can recall the feel of the film and the look of the film. But the story was kind of fresh because it had been so long. And I thought it was very good seeing it all again. Going into it, I was like, is this going to be one of those movies that you watch 30 years later and it, like, the memory of it is better than watching it again? No, I thought this one stood up. There were places where the storytelling was a bit slow, and it did suffer a little for that, especially for its time. I knew movies like Dances with Wolves were way longer, made this movie look like a short film. It starts to drag a bit in the middle, but the Sleeping Beauty moment at the end kind of was cheesy and stuff. That could have been done a little differently, but I get it. They were doing the symmetry with the father and had their little poetic moment. But overall, a very good, in the vein of ones that would come later, like Titanic was very much like, if you look at the storytelling and the historic backdrop, and you've got the rich boyfriend or ex-boyfriend versus the kind of street urchin who's trying to take you to a new life.
Yeah.
A lot of the template for this movie would be seen again in very successful movies that came over the next 10 years or so, because I think it got in ahead of those movies. A lot of people might not have seen this one, and they should probably rediscover it or discover it, period, and stream it if they're looking for a good flick on a Friday night. I think it does hold up.
This had a 50% on Rotten Tomatoes, so Sean was super braggy that his had the best score, so his must be the best movie, and I said no.
That does surprise me. And I guess it's just because people can see certain things about it as formulaic, or like I said, it does get a little long, especially for the time period. 2.5 hour movies like this weren't incredibly common yet. Now, if you go to a theater and see a movie and you're not there for 2.5 hours, people feel like, holy shit, where was the rest of the movie?
Yeah.
2.5 hours is just what we do now. But back then, no, it was 90 minutes, 2 hours tops. And so this movie was long for some people. You know, I think modern audiences should really kind of look at it with fresh eyes and give it another chance. People, I think, got hung up on the length.
That's what she said.
She got hung up on the length. If she hadn't picked up that bowl in the beginning of the movie and gotten hung up on the length, perhaps we wouldn't be talking right now.
It wouldn't even be a movie.
No. Before we go, I wanted to say, you mentioned earlier, and I know you're going to do some like teaser videos and stuff, so people listening can't necessarily see, but you were talking about your outfit being inspired by a scene from Far and Away. Uh-huh. When we were off the podcast, did you want to talk about that before we go bye-bye?
Oh, well, thank you. I did forget to mention all of that. I have put up a velvet curtain for my background with sequins. I'm thinking brothel. I'm thinking burlesque. This is nicer than what was in the movie, obviously, because I'm classy. But I do have, so my top has like a fishnet top part because one of the dancers had like fishnet gloves and stuff. And then I have a kimono because I imagine that's what they would cover up with when they were not on the stage. And yeah, it just felt good. It felt right. It went with the purple hair. And I loved all the different textures. And that was what I was trying to evoke because I love a theme and I love to dress for a theme. And so that was the thought that I put into this.
Meanwhile, I came to this podcast and sat down in front of a live camera looking like a street urchin who just did goddamn 3 hours of singing this morning, which I did, in front of some jabronis in a very hot room where they haven't turned the AC on yet.
Well, and nobody got to see you in your Lucha Libre mask.
Yeah.
Luchador.
I had my mask on earlier.
Is that the right name?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, luchador wrestlers. Yeah. That did not doll up as much as Haley. And I just want to say, I like that in the film, the Burlicue, is that what it was? The Burlicue, where Nicole Kidman's character danced, just happened to be in the exact same room where Tom Cruise would beat motherfuckers up for money. It was like, we do everything in this room.
Yeah.
We don't have a separate, no, you come here, you get dudes getting beaten within an inch of their life, and then you get almost naked chicks dancing on the stage over there. Whatever you fancy. Just find the right part of the room. Don't fuck up and wind up in the wrong place. Tom Cruise will punch you really hard.
I feel like it was sort of the version of like a male haircut place now where it's sort of sporty and there's like chicks with big boobs who cut your hair, whatever the fuck they do in there.
What? Where are these places?
That's what it reminds me of. Now, I know I forgot to ask this last time you were here, but do you want to tell people where they can hear your music or check you out?
Yeah, you can go to Spotify, Amazon, Apple, wherever you pick your poison, wherever you go and find your favorite music, Deezer. What's that one that fucking Puff Daddy runs? Hell, I'm on all the platforms, yo. I think I was trying to think of Tidal. But yeah, so anyway, Spotify, Amazon, Apple, all the regular, YouTube, wherever you stream your music. Brandon Mullis, M-U-L-L-I-S. I got originals. I got covers. I got a little bit of it all. So if you like some lyrical, folky, kind of folk rock, Americana type music, I might just be your new favorite artist. Probably not. But I hope I at least make the list. That's all I'm saying. It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me again. I appreciate you guys trusting part of the Haley Hates Everything empire in my hopefully capable hands. And I'm up for it anytime you guys want to do it again.
Yay. I'm so happy you could be here. It's been really fun. So check out Brandon. Listen to his stuff. It's good. It's good. And we're so happy that you could join us for the movie exchange. We hope that you had such a fun time. Well, I hate to say goodbye, but I'd love to watch you go because your ass is amazing. It's so
sexy. The fuck are you even talking to
I'm
now?
I'm talking to the people. This is what I do at the end of every podcast. Do you not make it to the end?
I was like, is this going to be a thing where Sean gets up and shakes it out of the room or something? Cause...
He can if he wants, but this is for the people. The compliments I'm pushing onto them. Because
I'm usually binging your show, so by the time I hear you wrapping it up, I'm on to the next episode. So I probably missed that comment because like,
I do it every
I'm like
time.
Mainlining Haley Hates Everything when I listen to it.
I do it every time at the end now. I talk about people's cabooses and I say, ooh, so cute. I just want to paint it. It's so cute. Things
well,
like
dang.
That. So bye, y'all.
Peace out, Brussels sprout.
Bye.